Welcome to Emotional Sobriety.
You got to recognize the other people on the playground if you want to have fun. It's like you can't just sit there and be, I'm going to sit over here by myself and be completely separate, and because I'm better than everybody, it won't work.
You know, it's what you're describing is that's the problem I wish I had sometimes, that I felt so head and shoulders above everyone else.
Get off your high horse, Patrick.
Yeah, I'm like, ooh, high horse. That sounds nice.
Yeah, it's hey, Alan, we're just talking about Patrick's arrogance.
Off the charts. I've been trying new accents, you know, the more haughty, the better.
Let's hear one.
Hello, boys. Welcome to the podcast. All right. So I'll just do a brief intro and then we can check in and then just we'll do this thing. And I know Alan's got a hard out in about 30 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Welcome to the pod. Alan and Tom on deck and myself. How's everybody doing today? How's our emotional sobriety?
Somebody can come in and check my emotional sobriety. I'm having a good time just hanging out, not doing much. Playing outside, doing a little work outside, not really giving a shit about much. So it's like, it's a good day.
I've had probably the last 3 days, the best 3 days I've had since the surgery.
Oh man, that's so good to hear.
In terms of pain. I mean, except right now I dropped a cane on my foot. So
you start this podcast off. Oh, Jesus.
Yeah. Don't do that. That hurts.
Yeah, but you know, it's like yesterday, I was able to, I mean, it sounds crazy, but I was so disabled, I wasn't even able to keep my house halfway clean. I mean,
no, I got it completely, buddy. My house went to shit.
My God, man, I spent probably a good 4 or 5 hours yesterday cleaning. I mean, my leg is tired. It's tired today from that, but I expect it to be. But it felt so good to get back some of my functioning. It's amazing how cleaning the house felt good, right?
Exactly. I mean, it's, yeah.
So that was cool. And I went, you know, twice now I went shopping by myself. I can't tell you what that's like. I mean, it's amazing some of these things I just took for granted. I've gotten my driving privileges back for about 2 weeks now, but I was, you know, in California most of that time. But it's I can feel that, you know, my leg is getting stronger. I can't do everything. And he told me that, you know, watch out. I'm giving you permission to be weight bearing with your cane. He says full weight bearing, but I don't want you jumping up and down. So no furious jumping. Mm-hmm. None of that right now.
So,
but,
so tennis will have to wait.
Tennis will have to wait, but I am so happy that I'm starting to.
Man, no, and I'm with you. I mean, right with you with the simplest things that I couldn't do or would exhaust me. You know, yeah. that was the thing. I could get up and do one thing or whatever, and it's like I could go out and do one thing outside, and I had to come back in and lie down. It's like I just had to rest. It's like, and it was, yeah, the idea that I could actually clean my house was miraculous. I love it.
No, it's unbelievable, those little things. And the other thing that's happening, and you know, this is understandable, but you know, I was in a pretty good place just before I got injured. Emotionally, I was starting to turn the corner. And I'll tell you, that that physical setback correlated with a very, very emotional regression. That I slipped back, man. I felt myself back in that place of being dependent again and starting to get very sad about things. But that's also changing. As I'm starting to feel good, it's like, you know, I'm ready for this next chapter in my life. I'm excited about it. And
you know, we could sort this out during a podcast, but it's like, because you heard me when I came back from my cancer stuff and you guys were saying, well, you really went into it with a good attitude and this stuff. And my, you know, on the other side of that, I came out saying, okay, well, just forget about that. Cause that attitude was gone within short order. And it's like, I ain't lying. It's like, I mean, I just felt like I lost my place. And on top of that, having lost my place, didn't give a shit, that I had. It was just, I too have come out and we're doing well, but what we could talk about is not so much like, oh, we shoulda, because we don't need that. But how can we use, you know, learn from the past, get the hell out of there? How could we have each of us done better to hold on to this emotional sobriety, even through the darker periods? Because I definitely didn't hold on to mine.
Well, you know, and that's a great question, Tom. I'll tell you, though, one of the things that you gave me early on when I was going through the divorce and all the other issues around that, the infidelity, you know, when you said, hey, just keep following my voice. You can't see the light, but follow my voice.
I remember. I
cannot tell you how hundreds of times I've remembered that. And it's just helped me get through some of those very dark periods of time where I couldn't see a future. I couldn't see
pitch black, man. I know it.
And if I did see it, it wasn't something pretty, man. It was filled with a lot of negativity, a lot of pessimism, even nihilism started to creep in on me. And I'm not that kind of person in general, but that one thing that you gave me, you know, amongst a lot of other things, you know, your support, all these other things, but just an image of that, and that's what I've held in my mind, is an image of it. Now, you standing around that corner and it's talking.
It's a very clear image for me too. It's like, yeah, I'm standing there. I can look to my it's going to be a left turn for you as you come toward me, and I'm looking straight down the tunnel to my right, and I see a perfectly clear open tunnel, big light. I can see that. That's your light. I can hear you in the pitch black in front of me, and for being completely dark, it was crystal clear. Yeah,
it's so powerful, that image. I mean, it really
for good,
really, really, really made a difference, man. How about you, Patrick? Where are you?
Well, I thought I'd pitch a question to you guys on the basis of what you both just said. How much time do you allocate for feeling sorry for yourself in the midst of all of your struggles? How much is too much? Because I feel like we need to account for just the misery sometimes of just being so out of control and trying to find our footing and not being well. You know, I've had my physical ailments and I've had some emotional challenges too lately. And I allow myself a little sip of just like, you know, that feeling like I'm somehow, especially worse than anything that my friends and family are going through at the same time.
But first of all, it's subjective. So I appreciate you asking that question. And to me, it's not chronological time. I couldn't say this is how much time. But it's like I had a good friend long, long, long time ago used to say, self-pity is a good place. It's a good place to visit. You just don't want to live there. It's like the idea is, you know, like what you're suggesting, I cringe when people don't let themselves feel bad for themselves at all, because they classify everything as self-pity. It's like, all I know is I don't need to stay there. I think that has to do as much with support. Most of the time I'll get myself up, brush myself off, and keep going. But I also know that I've surrounded myself, including you guys, with support people that if I don't, I'm not making you responsible for me, but if I don't, you're going to say something.
Yeah.
Well, you that know, I was reflecting on, the only thing that I've been doing consistently well, I feel like for the last couple of weeks or maybe longer than that, maybe even months, is I try to make a little bit of time every day, lots of little bits of time for the different people in my life that I care about. And oftentimes those aren't people that even live in my zip code. They're people that I've met during COVID over Zoom, people from AA meetings, friends and family. But I get on the phone or I go in person and I kind of check in. And anyway, I spend a lot of my time just listening to others talk about whatever the thing is. And it was funny because as I was thinking about that as kind of being like my program of life lately, I'm like, oh, so I'm like a therapist. That's what Alan's been doing. That's what you've been doing for a really long time, is you kind of check in with people on a regular basis. And it's not a bad life. I don't know. It gets me out of my head. That's for sure. I don't feel like I suck at it. I'm not a therapist.
You know what? One of the things that my therapist recently told me was that, because I was talking to her about, you know, self-pity, and, you know, part of me I always had this idea that it was wrong, right, to pity yourself, mm-hmm. right, that you were feeling sorry for yourself, you're being a sissy, or, you know, all those things. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, she said to me, you know, I think that people feel sorry for themselves when there's nobody around mm-hmm. them to have empathy for what their situation is. Mm-hmm. So it's That's our great. Attempt to empathize with ourselves and to give ourselves some support. And I can see that. I think that that can be, there's a lot of value to that. And I also agree with what you said, Tom, about, you know, it's important to go there and then, but not set up,
not you know, stay.
not set up a tent, right?
Yeah. Don't,
right? Don't plan on living there. Mm-hmm. But definitely, if you need to do that, you know, is to not shame yourself for doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. And what, Patrick, one of the things I want to say about you is just in our effort to just our group therapy here between the three of us is when you're describing what you're doing with friends and stuff, it's like that's one of the to me it's one of the characteristics of yours that I am very aware of in our relationship and in watching you with other people is you genuinely care about what's going on with other people. And when you because we all know people, and I probably have been that person at times who will ask somebody how they're doing and you know, and I'm not really paying attention to the answer. It's but you know, when you want to know what's going on, first of all, you'll ask me usually a specific question about something. If you know I'm working on something or something has been bothering me, you'll ask about it. But I mean, at a feeling level, in terms of if we were talking about emotional sobriety and relationship, for me, I trust that in you. When you ask me a question, I know you are interested in, and I want to give you an answer and want to have that conversation.
Well, I am. You know, it always struck me. There's this guy Steve L. From my home group. And you know what I'm talking about, right, Alan? And he's like a former special forces guy, and like super like not really in his feelings or in his head much compared to like most of the types I hang out with. And he had a stroke. He had like a bad medical setback, and then he was starting to go back to meetings. And he said something in one of the shares to the effect of, you know, without you, there is no me. He was trying to talk about mm-hmm. all the people that checked in on him and that, you know, he felt, And like, I just, that matters so much to me because like, I think it's a great way of saying, you know, like the real value, you know, in life and in our recovery more specifically is like in how we're reaching out to others. And, you know, I'm going to continue to try to live by that.
Well, let's jump into this article, huh?
Let's do it. So Worth It by BB from Mississauga, Ontario. A member in Canada. Oh, by the way, we need to have Josie on to read that, I think. Just saying. A member in Canada shares A member in Canada shares his long, wonderful story of relationships, sponsors, and living the good life. What kept me from seeking help with my drinking in my 20s was the idea I was too young to be an alcoholic. I also couldn't imagine my life without alcohol. I started drinking at age 15 back in Holland, where the legal drinking age was 16 at that time. I had my first major blackout shortly after turning 16. I have no recollection of being dropped off at home on the kitchen floor, where I was slapped so hard by my father that I woke up the next morning covered in blood from a nosebleed. When I was 21, I saw a program on TV that said, "If you drink this much per week, you are okay, but with this much, you may be in trouble, and with this much, you are definitely in trouble." I drank more than the definitely in trouble limit, but I was only 21. How can you be definitely an alcoholic at that age? Plus, I was a somewhat successful university student. I had a girlfriend and I had ambitions.
Yes, I had failed my first year of university by trying to combine competitive varsity rowing with drinking. So I quit the rowing. And yes, I knew even at 21 that when I started to drink, I couldn't really stop. But that didn't make me an alcoholic, right? I got a scholarship from the Norwegian government and married my girlfriend so she could come with me. So off we went. But I was not married for long. Once she and I were in Norway, the fractures in our relationship started to show very quickly. discussions about our problems only happened with a bottle of whiskey on the table. And after four doubles and a few beers, I would agree to anything as long as she went to sleep so I could get back to drinking. She left me and went back to Holland.
In my last months in Norway, I met a beautiful woman, an engineer who was already accepted for engineering for immigration to Canada. She could not stay in Norway, and I had to go back to Holland to graduate. Neither of us wanted a serious relationship, but that was what we got eventually. Back in Holland, life was dismal due to my divorce, but I found a prestigious job in a European training program with a large computer company. I drank scary amounts of alcohol. I blacked out often, but I never got a DUI because there were no ride checks in those days in the mornings. I was quite smitten with the woman I had met in Norway. So I looked her up in Canada and we clicked. Good things can happen during your drinking days. And this was one of them. To make a long story short, I moved to Canada. We married and for a while things were great. She already had a daughter from a previous marriage and I came to love her child like my own.
But I was not the father I thought I would be. When my wife traveled for work, I often drank myself into blackouts at night. Anything could happen, and the shame, guilt, and remorse we in AA talk about so much started to build. My wife and I argued more and more about my drinking, and I became an expert at hiding large amounts of rum in my glass. 8 months after getting married for the second time, having just turned 30, my wife told me she would throw me out if I kept doing what I was doing. It was January 1st, 1983, and I had one hell of a hangover. The next day, a Sunday, I finally called AA, and the person answering the phone invited me to come over to the AA central office in downtown. It wasn't until many years later when I started working the phones myself that I realized how unusual this was, but this invitation saved my life.
There I met two young men, Bill and Daryl, who were 5 and 7 years sober, so they said. I found that hard to believe since I could rarely string together 2 or 3 days without drinking, which I had desperately tried to do. However, when they spoke about the obsession to drink, I related. They talked about alcohol the way I felt about it. I related to their stories. What astonished me the most was that they didn't drink, but still seemed to be happy. When they mentioned not drinking just one day at a time, I got some faint hope because I did not drink every day. Daryl invited me to go to a meeting with him that Sunday. Just be at the corner of Hastings by 7 p.m. I'll pick you up. I said yes, and I did not drink for a whole week, which had not happened for me in a very long time.
Daryl picked me up, as promised, and I rolled into a closed men's home step group. We did step one at that meeting, and I did not drink for another week. I went to the meeting again. Back then, we met in the kitchen and basements of our homes and did the steps. This was another quite unusual intervention in my life. It was true, old-fashioned AA. And I kept going, and I didn't drink and found other meetings. My experience showed me that when you stop drinking, you meet somebody you don't really like. And that somebody is you. Although I was very scared of losing the woman I loved, I also realized the problem was mine. The saying, if you start drinking at 15, you'll be 15 years old emotionally when you sober up, started to make sense.
Yeah.
In retrospect, being young in AA is an advantage. Our habits are less ingrained than when we're 50 or 60. Also, being a new immigrant, I learned a lot of new words in AA. All sorts of stuff they never teach you in school, from the word Mickey to how to do a high five when you reach a sobriety milestone. Daryl became my sponsor, and slowly I did what I had always avoided. Grow up, take responsibility, think of others first, and voluntarily do a bit more than the bare minimum. I learned that sobriety is not just about not drinking. It's about appreciating sober life, no matter what happens. Be honest, stand up for myself, speak out, tell people how I really feel, especially with the people closest to me. Finding a balance between AA, home life, and work was, and is, one of the most difficult things to achieve.
I am now 36 years sober. I learned to love the sober context, as I heard a speaker once say. When my father died, I felt sad, but it was okay. When my wife got cancer, it was hard on all of us, but I was grateful for being able to be there for her. After that ordeal, at more than 30 years sober, I needed counseling. AA was not enough, and that's okay. Fortunately, I also have a great sponsor, my fifth. He helped me get a deeper understanding of the Serenity Prayer. Long-term sobriety is no guarantee against deeply ingrained character flaws that can come back and bite me, but it does make day-to-day living a lot easier.
Oh, I always think there's a promise missing in the big book. Mm. One that I heard an old timer say when I was fairly new in the program, if you stay sober long enough, you get to hold the baby. That's exactly what happened because we had two more daughters after I sobered up and later a few grandkids. The two youngest ones never saw me drink, for which I'm immensely grateful. So if you are young and new, please stay. Try to grab on and enjoy the ride of a sober life. It can be hard at times, but it is so worth it. Wow, so many great little gems in that one, huh?
Yeah, so many places where I identify with that guy. Yeah, with his denial, with his ability to keep saying, you know, because I was in the business of alcohol and drug treatment before I got sober. So I was, I always say my denial had to work overtime. I had to keep, I had to figure out how I was different from these guys I was treating, you know? So, you know, and what I found, my joke was it wasn't enough just to say that alcoholics drive you to drink.
His timeline is about the same as mine as well. I got sober around age 30. And mm-hmm. so it was really just like I cleared out as much as I could in my 20s. And I get to the end and I'm just like, all right, well, time to do something different. The thing about not liking the person you meet when you sober up, though, like I got to say, like me off the chemicals for like a few days, if not a week, I did like that person right away a lot better than the guy I was mm-hmm. formerly. But I think I get his meaning.
Well, I think what happens is what we talk about. See, this is what Bill was saying, I think, all along, is that when we start to sober up, and Ernie Larson said this too, you get clear-headed enough to start realizing that we all have problems with living. And mm-hmm. that's it. And it's because of our arrested development. Not that we're pathological. I've really rejected that idea now, but that we have arrested development. You know, we haven't grown up to being able to learn how to support ourselves yet. And so what Bill said is we have to cut those almost absolute dependencies away if we're going to be able to really fully enjoy all of the benefits of recovery. You know, people can stay sober without that, but the quality of it is different. There's no question about it. I've seen it, and I've seen people have those experiences. But if you want what we could call full recovery or completely recovery, you've got to get down and deal with this emotional dependency issue that Bill identified. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's one. The other thing that really stood out for me that in this issue, or in this particular article in this issue, was this idea that if we continue to show up, right, we cannot predict what's going to happen in our future. We don't know what path, what turns, what twists, what, you know, life, one constant in life is change. And a lot of times, you know, we don't want that. We want certainty. We want today to be tomorrow, but it's not going to be. I mean, it's going to be filled with a lot of changes. And the issue in this is not in, you know, we've said it so many times, you know, how did Rocky say it, Tom? It's not how hard you hit.
It's how hard you can get hit and keep coming.
Keep coming. And see, that's the issue. And look at all three of us are a living testimony of that right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Tom Catton, who I got sober with early on back in 71, you know, he used to say this. He says, you know, staying clean and sober has to do with not drinking or getting high when it would make a lot more sense to do so.
I've heard you say that before. That is so right.
I love
on.
That. It's one of those nutshells, you know,
perfect.
I think are so important for us to keep in mind. It's that it's, if we hang in there, no matter how dark it seems, and Tom and I were talking about this beforehand, if you just hear our voices and keep walking towards us, if you can't see the light, just continue to come and hear our voices. Eventually, you'll get to that that turn, right? That
Right,
angle.
right. Just
And you'll
keep
be able
coming.
to make that turn and just keep coming to our voices if you're listening to us and you're
Yeah.
struggling.
Yeah.
Because there it is. And this is this guy told you, you know, now it doesn't mean all his problems are solved and stuff. He's enjoying, he's got all the benefits of life. But I say to people today, the measure of my life is not whether I'm happy. Yes, I enjoy happiness like anybody else. I want that. Of course I do. But the measure of my life today is how I embrace life as it comes to me. That's to me the measure of life for me today. It's not just about happiness. It's not about getting things and things going my way. It's about how to show up regardless.
Tend your life, tend your myth, cultivate your narrative with whomever you are.